Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, at a discombobulating time, it's a waxing full moon whose metaphoric proffering to us is Eleusinian mysteries, micro to macro, Mercury stationing to retrograde. Again, not superstitious, just noticing the stories. It is to remember what we've forgotten. And everything takes many schedulings, and it's like, whoa. But more than perfectly, the one thing that wanted to happen to redo is to re-host Damon Tai. And we go, may our rogue species re-enter the choreography of creation rather than disrupting nature's diverse equilibrium. So we do segue from last week, again hosting citizen naturalist Damon Tai on the unfolding die-off at Lake Merritt, Oakland, and the San Francisco Bay. You know, let's keep this crisis on the altar of urgent pertinence. Damon's a naturalist with a 20-year history observing the organisms and fungi of Lake Merritt. Naturalist.org is a great place where citizens can upload observations, and you can also find Damon Tai, T-I-G-H-E. He's also a naturalist organizer at California Center for Natural History and the curriculum and training specialist at Bio-Rad Laboratories. And it was so kind of you, Damon, to confabulate your schedule to be able to be here, and patient of the people with whom you work. Welcome, Damon.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, no, it's a great pleasure. Well, there's much. I mean, you said so much beauty last week, and I encourage everyone to listen to last week's show as well. But you were talking about you said your obsession with the natural world, and I was like, your dedication with the with the natural world, and you know, and solace and creativity. You said, you know, approaching the world with, you know, what are you, who are you, you know, what's your story, and it said, you know, your love of what you study makes you go out with intention to see, going out with intention. That was so great, and there's more to report on, and also the images that you sent me from Instagram that we can comment on as we go. So where are we now? Wait, let me just read one more thing that you sent. You said the paper predicts this algae bloom based upon current levels of nutrients flowing into the bay, and it's sort of a miracle, hasn't happened yet, but now we're likely past the tipping point. You say, if an aberrant nutrient leak isn't discovered that kicked this bloom off, it means all bay, our cities, municipalities are going to have to come to the table and lower nutrients into the bay. This likely would be slow, painful, billions of dollars, and the chance of this summer event taking place again. You say, and let's underline this for everybody, let's take the tragedy and turn it into a triumph by motivating the public for public agencies to work as fast as possible. The decisions need to be fast because the engineering is not trivial.
That's a very accurate summary of where we're at. That's a very accurate summary of where we're at. And it's hard because there's so many variables at play. So the San Francisco Bay is a very complex system. And we've got a lot of variables we can watch during this. But based on that paper that I sent to you, it's by Clarin et al. About 2020. They kind of, you know, look at the San Francisco Bay and compare it to other bodies of water that are similar by large metropolitan areas and their, you know, eutrophic events, these algal blooms and things like that, and kind of bring to the highlight, like, it's very strange. It has not happened in the SF Bay yet, because we know our nutrient levels are very high compared to some of these systems that are already having problems. And so it seems like from a nutrient side, we may have already kind of walked across this tipping point. And that's not to say that there might not be other variables involved, like our drought, which means we have less fresh water entering our estuary system, which also brings with it silt and particles that help more or less deflect what's going on with photosynthesis in the bay. And then the more experts you can find, the more variables you can find that are affecting this. But I think the nutrients one is pretty hard to ignore, because it's been on a lot of people's minds for quite some time. And so I think that's what's been kind of after the major die-offs have taken. I'd say we haven't seen another big spike in new dead fish showing up places. And so now becomes the difficult part of all of this, which is keeping attention that this event has happened, is continuing to affect us, and to inactivate change around trying to prevent these events from happening in the future, because they will happen in the future. I mean, even if we started engineering our way today to get a lot of these nutrients under control, it's a multi-year process. And before we can even do that, we've got to get agencies working together to decide, you know, who's taking which piece of the pie and how do we work on this together? And we all know that that's not always the fastest process. So we're in a really interesting dynamic time right now, I think, in going after this thing that's affecting all of us.
Right, and it's everywhere. You know, the eutrophication link from NASA that I sent you just it just you know, in a mm-hmm. brief way said, you know, it's everywhere. It doesn't matter if you're on the coast. You know, it's an everywhere harmful algal blooms, dead zones, fish kills are the result of a process called eutrophication, which begins with increased loads of nutrients to estuaries and coastal waters. And then that article is short, you know, but it says it's a problem that should matter to you whether you live near the ocean or not. That's because it begins wherever people live and ends with damage to resources we all use and enjoy when nutrients get into lakes and oceans. And it goes on to explain, you know, more of that process. So we're heading in, and as you say, you know, there's no, well, it's complex. It's time for complexity. And a large thing I just want to put on our altar of desirable miracles, you know, is what shall our species cultivate, right? What qualities mm-hmm. do we want to cultivate? You did a great, wonderful proffering last week, you know, curiosity and wonder. We go, yes, and respect. The word respect is great because it means to look at again, re again, inspect, look, like re, keep looking, you know, to find something to respect. So, and might we say, you know, we want to, as a species, cultivate manners, but also the capacity for complexity and complex storytellings, that it's not just one thing. And as you say, you know, we're headed in, yeah.
No, I was going to say, yeah, and that's always a hard thing, I mean, for me as an individual to do too, right? Because when we go to make decisions in our lives about everyday things, it's much easier if you're not going in having 400 things you need to look at in order to pare them down to one decision, right? It's easier to be like, it's this or that. And so it's the human impulse to do that, right? And on things like this, you know, we kind of try to like quickly bin things down so we can say, here are the major components, especially on something like this where we're trying to kind of get, you know, respect that the land and the processes that the earth has created for us. You know, how do we get back in line with that sooner? And we can kind of look through our options and be like, okay, these are basically the largest, you know, deviations that we've done, you know, in this area. You know, which of these can we start working on right now while we continue to respect, you know, re-inspect those habitats to understand that complexity. And I think that's one of the things that, I mean, as a scientist, I've always kind of had a balancing problem with, which is, I always would love to know more, but there's also a cost to knowing more, which is the urgency of fixing a problem as well. And so we always have to like find where that balance is, that dance with wanting to learn more before we make a decision and then being able to at least take action to start recorrecting the course potentially.
But there is also some speculative animism we might put on our work table too, which is, you know, always learning. And my brother-in-law, who's a big deal, won Nobel Prize in science, rational but good guy, you know, and he said he's in favor of just everybody learn as much as possible, because I might not find out what I need from my study, but I'm going to find something that you need over here and vice versa. And so on one level, it's like, learn everything. And then there's a kind of
synchronous. He's so right in that. Sorry.
Right. No, that's great. Feel free. And one of the good things is that he's absolutely in favor of the democratization of science, that all knowledge should be available to all people globally, for free, you know, and just mm-hmm. everything. Who brought what? Who knows what? Who's studying this little thing over here that we don't know, but it's crucial to the work going on over here. So it's really like Renaissance, right? It's like, you know, study everything, and what is the what is the good part of humans, right? I like Matthew Arnold saying, to be cultured is to be acquainted with the highest possibilities of the human spirit throughout time. And I always quibble with the quote going, that's pretty good, but not just humans. The highest possibilities of sturgeon and wolves and slime mold, you know, the highest possibilities of everything. And we spoke a little bit, you know, last week, and then sort of backstage too, going, you know, biomimicry and, you know, the ideal panel I would want to put together at Bioneers, which will be in Berkeley in April, of, you know, you and some other science people, micro and macrobiology people, and Janine Benyus in a dream world, and going, all right, because it is about what you do, deep observation of intrinsic order, and how do we participate rather than disrupt. And mm-hmm. I did love the image. Oh yeah, go. Yeah.
Just say, I do want to swing back to your brother's comment really quick, because I think that to some degree is the fruit of what we talked about last time for me, which is there's so much that we don't know, and I think a lot of people don't quite realize that. Because we look around us and we're like, man, humans, we've done a lot of amazing things. I have all of these tools, like I'm not, you know, just trying to find food and water every day for, you know, not everyone, you know, and it's like there's a lot of technology that we build, which also has built up this giant, you know, hubris layer to us where we think we know a lot. But as soon as you start looking at one little thing, you realize like, oh man, I don't have a lifetime to figure that out. I really hope there's some other people wanting to do this. And I mean, if you even just took all of the people on the planet right now and gave them like, here's the window I want you to explore in the world and find, we would still need hundreds, if not thousands of generations to even start to scrape the surface of what goes on just this planet. And I think that's one of the hard things like for people, some people to conceptualize. So I just put in context with this algae we're dealing with. I was asking myself, well, how much do we know about algae? Like, you gotta remember, this is not my field. I'm not a marine biologist. I'm not a limnologist. I'm a mobile molecular guy. And so I started digging, like, well, what do we know about just the taxonomy? Like, how well can we name these things? And there's still not a good estimate on just even the number of algal species out there. I see estimates from 30,000 up to 1 million. That's a big set of error bars, which tells me we don't know a whole bunch. And even there was a great Instagram Live earlier today with some folks from UC Berkeley and the San Francisco Estuary Institute. And one of the questions I asked them was, like, I heard that we might not even that we have a species name for this thing, but it might be cryptic, i.e. the algae we have out there, we have a name for it, but that name might actually represent lots of different organisms that we just haven't identified yet. And they were like, well, yeah, we don't, you know, we're not 100% sure, you know? And it's like those type of things, like I think is that open world of like, wow, there's a lot of curiosity for all of us to dive into. And by that curiosity, we would then have these tools to start answering problematic questions when things like this come up, you know. But it all starts with us learning how to generate our own natural curiosity in the world, you know, stepping out that front door and even just asking, hey, you organisms here right at my doorstep, who are you? What do you do? How do you interact with each other? What's good? You know, what do you like? What do you not like? And then as that scales up to understanding more of the world around you, then we get more potential, I feel, to like know our place within all of these major mechanisms, you know, of history and time and biology and geology and all of that, and to kind of know, you know, what we can get away with and what we can't get away with, which I think is something humanity is really struggling with right now.
Yes, no, and several miles back, but I didn't want to interrupt you. Did you say a giant humus layer or a giant hubris layer?
Hubris layer.
Oh, that's perfect. Oh, that's perfect. No, that's great. No, that's right. No, that's great. No, a giant hubris layer is really deft. Yeah, we want to replace hubris with humus. There we go. And then that calling of ingenuity, you know, it's like I've often thought, you know, of, you know, who brought what and the incentive, and even to turn to we want to aerate our culture with, like, how about this and how about that, you know, even to go to, you know, Bay Area and Oakland high schools and say, you know, we're looking for solutions and knowledge, you know, who's willing to work on this, you know, to turn everyone's ingenuity into immediate, you know, how shall we cooperate with our environment, you know, and just that realm. We want the awakened imagination, and I've thought for years, going, yes, ingenuity, you know, contests and in high schools, and if you come up with a solution that we implement, then you get a complete, you know, 4-year free scholarship to college or whatever the thing is. But it's sort of like experiment. You said, you know, the wealth also is education, and, you know, mm-hmm. untapped wealth, and kind of what you know, my brother-in-law said, you know, is that you don't know where the solution's going to come from, and you yourself, you know, are the much in demand and generously contributing citizen naturalist. You know, you're a molecular biologist, but you love this lake, and so you're called on, and so in that sense of, yeah, right. Well, I know you're very much in demand, you know, but are there people talking to Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco high schools about this?
About this event, I think the word is still kind of permeating. Like, I know I've already kind of signed up to go talk to a couple of high schools. Have teachers that I've worked with previously that have already asked, you know, hey, do you have materials that I can at least start broaching these subjects in my class? I even have, like, teacher friend in Arizona who's like, hey, I saw this, you're on the news, I've already grabbed this, we just happen to be talking about this type of subject anyway with Arizona, and this brings it back and makes it very timely. So I mean, this is getting done in classrooms. I think what, at least for the Bay Area, what this has done for like a high school teacher or a classroom teacher in the Bay Area, it's all of a sudden made this a very pertinent local thing to talk about, you know, where other schools I've worked with in the past in my history have had events like this close by, and so they were already kind of talking about them. So, like, one's up in the Pacific Northwest, close to, like, Hood Canal, that has major problems with or the same organism occasionally. They've been talking about it in their classrooms for years, you know, and ultimately that's probably where some of the solutions are going to come from, right? Are those students who that initial introduction gets them interested in what's going on, and they want to see their local environment better? And so they end up going down a trajectory that brings them into a field maybe that contributes to us figuring out how to deal with these, how to minimize our impacts that lead to these type of events. So, I mean, I have great hope. I have great hope of education helping bring more people in to look at these, to be curious about these events and other things. I mean, that's one of the biggest things, I think, is when I walk into a classroom and some teachers have open-ended sorts of curiosity things that they do with students, and not necessarily, I want to show you this technique, or I've got these two talking points I want to tell you about. But when I walk in a classroom and I see teachers that are just like, I just want us to explore this and let me know where your curiosity goes, and then I will support you in that. I feel like that's another really big aspect of education. It gets us these people that do the contributions, you know, like your, you know, brother-in-law has said, like, we don't know what leads to the next big thing. And we always see this in primary science. It's always these, like, random fields all of a sudden merge because somebody makes the tie between them. And that's where, like, a new technology feels like it came out of nowhere. But then if you trace it back, you're like, oh, no, this has, you know, lineages, decades, if not hundreds of years old. Here's all of these different fields coming together, but they were unrelated before.
Right. Right. Again, that's why we want focused knowledge and broad knowledge, because it is all, you know, to cross, because the problems that we've imposed on the world are complex and cross borders. So, yeah, the curiosity and the invitation, and part of what we've done on this show for a while is to say, you know, to be effective communicators, you know, did you know is a great question, because nobody minds being asked that unless we're snarky, like, did you know? Did you know? Did you know? And here I'm turning to some of the images that did you know that sturgeon, right? Well, I love this photo. A living fossil from another age, a spirit incarnate, able to survive all but our ignorance, all but human greed, as white supremacy reigns supreme. Okay, that's right. I do. As we lose touch with wonder and you know, and porn. But did you know? And then a friend remembers from last week you saying, you said the sturgeon are the redwoods of the waterways, right? Which is
And that's, and I mean, I remember as like a small child, like I had that same wonder with the first sturgeon I ever saw. I think I was with my grandpa, and I think I was 10, and he was a fisherman, and like we happened to have, I think, pulled one out near Rio Vista. And I remember just being like, it's one of those things when you first see it, your brain is just, your brain's like just running around in circles being like, where does this fit? It's just, it's so magnificent. It's so beautiful. And it just, where did this come from? And it's the same way that I think I felt when I first saw, you know, a giant sequoia. And I'm just, I mean, I deeply feel it in me right now, like this sadness and this motivation to make sure that like generations forward get that feeling, that wonder, that respect for this, for these types of organisms. And, you know, this event definitely leads us to a precipitous point where they might not be there, you know, if these events continue to take place. But we've got that hope, we've got that potential to turn this around.
Right, right. Again, necessary miracles and mobilization and, you know, yes, cultivating curiosity and the Lauren Isley, you know, our inner naturalist of curiosity, because we remember these things. I remember as a little girl walking down the beach with my 7 years older than me sister, looking at horseshoe crabs that were at that point abundant and now they're gone. And she said, you know, those are 2 million years old in that shape because they're perfect. And I just remember that. And then we turned them into dog food and stuff, and they're mostly gone. They were so abundant, right? So we're looking at the diminution of abundance. And it is that moment where you're like, oh, something's gone. Something's missing. We don't see it first. But that's what you're really keyed to. And, you know, I was... you know, just keeping in touch with Mitch Jezerich's, you know, feed, right? Because he's how I found you, and there you were on his show, and there we go. And so, so he was saying that now the birds are missing, the cormorants and the pelicans. Mm-hmm. Yes, he said the lake was a dead zone. The oxygen levels are rebounding, but also the city just came and you know, what bulldozed a whole bunch of fish. And then I sent you from a listener. She was like, I took some fish and put them in my garden. And it's like, yeah, at least that would be good. That would be good. But the birds, the cormorants and the pelicans, what scouting report might you want to file on their behalf?
So I can back up what Mitch has been reporting as well, which is when I've dropped to Lake Merritt in the last couple of days, you know, the fishing birds are gone. You know, you don't see the pelicans, you don't see the cormorants. The only bird that's really been there in big numbers has been seagulls, and now even their numbers are starting to dwindle. They're even running out of, you know, things to pick up off the water surface. And I was helping out do some dissolved oxygen readings a few days ago around Alameda, and we were seeing the same thing there when talking to people, that they're usually, you know, at Encinal kind of beach. They're like, there's usually pelican action here, and we only saw one that entire day. So they're also flying someplace else to find food. And this is, you know, and this is a hearkening like event where we're going to start to see some bad things happen to the birds in the next couple months, is my gut feeling, because you just wiped out so much of their food. They're either going to have to move someplace else to try to go find food, and Bay Area is pretty hard to beat. It's a great buffet here, or we're going to start seeing birds starving. And so like, I'm worried about that next phase of this, which is where the charismatic kind of megafauna of our estuary starts showing signs of the food web being hit very hard by this event.
So you don't think, so the birds are not poisoned, they're just hungry.
I think they're just hungry, but you know, there's still big asterisks on that, because with this specific algae, there still is some degree of, you know, suspicion that there is a neurotoxin involved. And there are people testing for that right now. Yeah. I think California Water Board is involved in that. And I'm not sure if one of the UC groups is also involved in that, but I know it's something that a handful of people are trying to kind of sort out. But if anything, if it's a neurotoxin, it doesn't seem to be, you know, a very potent one, at least from what we can tell, because otherwise this would be an even worse event, because we would see very immediately, I think, bird die-offs, seal and sea lion problems. I know I found a couple dead birds in front of San Leandro, which gives me a little bit of pause. I found a handful of cormorants there dead 3 days ago when doing a survey for sturgeon. But I'm not seeing too many more reports of that. So that's why I'm kind of like, I feel like we might be, you know, missing a bolt on that one, I hope.
Right. And then one of the things about our species that we want to wish well, you know, we spoke about it a little bit last week about, you know, the illusion of sudden, like, la, 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 oh, suddenly this happened. And it's like, no, it was developing for a very long time. And we talked about, you know, what is invisible, and that, you know, death made the invisible visible. People saying, I hadn't seen a ray before, and now I see a dead one, you know. And so there's many things brewing, and it's like if we could kick our addiction to crisis, right? Oh, that seems, well, we put impossible things on the table, right? You know, in our own micro and macro way. But it's like, you know, to be informed and monitoring and talking to what's going on, what's the health level before this, you know, the huge crisis die-off, the whatever. And that's why I was so enthused and grateful to have you back on the show this week, so that this issue doesn't just go, well, that's handled, you know, and that we keep things on our work table.
And I think it's, you know, that's a tough one, because it takes a large body politic of people that observe and have been doing that for a while with a space, right? And they see when things are just a little bit different. And they go, hey, I think there's something new going on here. Is anybody else seeing this? You know, is this something to be concerned with? And we have a little bit of that, right, with like within the scientific community, but it's a very small group, and they're not always good at translating for the public. You know, like this paper that I shared with you from Clarinet et al., you know, that came out 2 years ago. I think it was actually attempted to be published in 2019. And I would say that was a pretty good warning shot. You know, this was seeing the iceberg out in the distance and saying, hey, we were headed there. We should think about this. But, you know, I don't think that paper until now, right, really resounds with people, where if we had more people that had started to notice differences just around the bay and the way that things were behaving and kind of mobilized around that, I think there would have been a chance to kind of get in front of this before we have to be led by crisis. Because we don't want to be led by crisis. We want to be led by logic and by love and by respect of the places that we live.
Right. No, and it's also we'll take a short break, in a moment, but we touched on this last week as well, but these are ongoing and really in foreseeable perpetuity things, the issue of expediency, you know, as the paper said, you know, or you know, that the solution, complex though they may be, is in the billions of dollars, and it's not just here. It's everywhere, and therefore the expediency is like, well, no, that's invisible. It's too complex. It's fine, you know. And then just pushing it back down, and you know, humans disrupting rather than participating in equilibrium, and that comes back to great oceanographer, you know, several times guest, you know, Dave Gallo, who wants to. With all of his oceanographic knowledge, he wants to completely redo education, you know, and to teach, you know, again, what you love, you know, which is curiosity and wonder and approaching, and that we live in a storytelling creation, you know, approach the world with that, going, what's up here, and how do we fit in, you know, all stories lead us to all stories. So this leads us to, well, we're going to have to redo our waste systems and the whole thing. And that's this particular catastrophe, but it's any catastrophe, And we're going to take our very short usual musical break. Our guest this hour, again, wonderfully, is Damon Tai. And we are looking at humans, participating in equilibrium. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Ooh, chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Thank you always for 26 years, Taj Mahal, for that break music. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and we are segueing and so grateful to host again last week's guest, now here again, a naturalist, citizen naturalist, Damon Tai, on the unfolding die-off at Lake Merritt, Oakland, the San Francisco Bay, and really it's pertinent everywhere. And let's keep this crisis on the altar of urgent pertinence, that it not blah, blah, blah back down into people thinking, well, that's handled. No, we're in the middle of the thing. And somebody commenting on what Mitch Jezerich had been posting said, well, we need a good winter with fresh rain water to flush this out. And it's like, oh, there's no counting on that, though, is there?
Yeah, there's. Not with our current weather patterns. There is not. And that could help, you know, if we do get some good rain, it does help. But we've got to also have that strong consideration that things may have tipped and we might not be seeing those type of weather events anymore. Which means we would anticipate change, right, within a system. But I think what we need to figure out is how do we roll with the new system and figure out how not to let it kind of exacerbate, you know, problems we already had mounting.
Yes. Well, you know, and again, we're on a waxing full moon. Woo! Okay. And Mercury is appearing to move backwards, and which is everything takes several. The best thing that happened, you know, today and yesterday was rebooking you, Damon, because I'd forgotten that I already had another guest booked, but I'm like, no, never mind you, out of the way for Damon, right? Because it's been very like, no, not this, but this over here. No, there we go. That. And we are approaching the equinox that humans have, you know, honored and wanted to participate with for over 25,000 years. And it was when humans dedicated to coming back into harmonious equilibrium. That's equinox, equal night and day, you know, equal all of that. And so it's like, so that's there. There was somewhere, a San Francisco Chronicle article, it was protected by a paywall, but I got the gist of it, and it just said, poop and pee, this is the headline, fueled a huge algae bloom in San Francisco Bay, but it could cost $14 billion to redress that, right? So there's always people going, oh, that's too much, you know, but that's only one factor, right? We think human waste, and that's why our intimacy with our environment, you know, where does our waste go? And that's why I sent you the John Todd Living Systems, you know, kind of link. I think John Todd has become an ancestor, but his work continues too. The living systems of filtration and ingenuity that they did implement in Providence, Rhode Island, a surprisingly interesting place there, which was just, again, biomimicry, wetlands to filter out the waste. So it is a huge incentive. So if human waste is part of fueling the algae bloom, is that your understanding?
That's my understanding. Because the research paper I sent, it kind of looked at what are the sources of nitrogen and phosphorus, the kind of the two major factors usually in these algal blooms, and they for the San Francisco Bay. And based upon their conclusions, they're saying, you know, about 60% is basically human waste coming out of, you know, treatment plants. Ooh. Maybe about 15% or so is agricultural fertilizers coming down through the Bay Delta. Another 15-20% is actually urban runoff, you know, fertilizers people are using around their homes and just other things that are getting into kind of storm drains and ending up in the bay. And so the biggest chunk of the pie there is the consolidated human waste, which is good and bad, right? At least it's already, you know, quote unquote, in one or two pipes per se, you know, there's multiple pipes going into the bay and multiple sewage treatment facilities that release into the bay, but it's not, you know, every single person, we've got to figure out how to modify every single person's behavior in order to get this to slow down. You know, there's, like as the Chronicle piece suggests, there's some things we can already put back of the envelope numbers on, you know, of engineering that could be done to these systems to decrease how much of these nutrients are entering up into the bay. And there's, you know, and that's kind of, I would say, you know, what you consider agency speak of how we're going to solve this, right? Huge engineering project. But then there's also, you know, if you go down to the next level of like communities talking, then you see all these people talking about other ways we can do it, you know, that are more of like biomimicry type of stuff, more of personally, what can I do? You know, maybe I want to use a composting toilet. Maybe I have the luxury of having enough land where I can do that and have that be a portion of the way that I manage my own waste. There's talk about just capturing urine as a way to decrease, especially phosphorus outputs into these waste streams. I mean, what I love about this is there's already been a lot of human thought around what to do with our waste, because it's been a problem ever since we got into cities, right? And humans have many great ways of like dealing with it and using it as a resource and not something that we have to get rid of. There's a great book called it's a play on Darwin's book, The Origin of Feces, I think is the name of the book. And this author gets into the entire history of humans' use of feces and our current kind of use of feces, which is, oh my God, let's get it away from everybody and then just get it out of our sight.
Right. Well, yeah. And then some people say, you know, it all goes back to when did humans first, you know, dump waste and human waste into water? I mean, we're going way back. But there there are cultures, you know, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, some of the earliest civilizations, did not do that. They did not dump their waste into water. You know, and we go, yeah, the origin of feces. And what I thought you were going to, that's great. And then, you know, years ago hosted author something George, you know, on the big necessity, which is what to do with human waste, which is a huge thing.
Yeah,
and she put on boots and went into every human sewer system around the world. Rose George, bless her heart. You know, and also just as a little side thing, which is why one must never, ever, ever flush a Q-tip down the toilet, because it's the shape that completely blocks. It you know, the small thing can take down the large thing. A Q-tip will take down an entire sewage center. But anyway, so back to that. But the big necessity and waste, you know, somebody defined, you know, environmental as no waste. We go, that's good. And that comes back to, where did all the dead fish go? Did they go to a landfill?
Yeah.
The oh no. Oh right.
From what I understand, they went to an incinerator. I don't have it like from the horse's mouth, but I think one of the articles I read like noted that that's where they were going, and I was kind of like, oh, I mean, I understand like why, you know, why an agency, why a city might do that, right? Because they're worried like, oh, if there is a toxin, the last thing we want to do is multiply where the toxin is at, you know. So I think that was done out of, you know, not knowing 100% and trying to minimize damage, but at the same time, right? People are going like, well, you probably could have taken the fish, you know, let it decay, you know, in my backyard, and that toxin's really not going to be there, because most of these toxins tend to be stuff that, you know, that microbes will break down. You just have to give them time. So that's, yeah, I feel both sides on that one.
Well, wait, what are the both sides? One is like, yeah, they had to get rid of it. Let's see. There's
one is we don't want to cause more harm, right? Hepatic growth type of thing, which is if I don't know that this doesn't have a toxin. Right. I don't want to send it home with people and have them buried in their backyards and make, you know, potentially fantastic soil from it. But then the other side is missing out on that chance to make fantastic soil, right? So it's kind of a,
right.
It's a tough one because it comes back to this thing that we don't know, right? If we just had more people who are curious about this organism earlier, maybe we would already know.
Well, and then yeah. I just remember a curious fact from a million years ago when my sister was living in San Francisco, and that they were getting composted human waste from the city. And she said that's where she had incredible admiration for the tomato plant, because it would go through this high temperature composting thing, you know, and they'd use it and tomato plants would sprout going amazing, mm-hmm. amazing, you know, just the life force of tomato seeds. But yeah, overwhelmed. And that's why it's like, you know, part of, you know, being overwhelmed, not prepared. So you can say, right, that so they did. Well, and then they burned it, and then what? And then what happened to all the dead fish that were burned? What do you think?
I don't know what type of incineration they were doing. They probably said ash, right? That probably then did go to some sort of, like, landfill, is my guess. I'm not sure where that material goes, what happened to it. But the point out, though, is I think that's important here, which is we're behaving, I don't want to say like children, but like, you know, teenagers, we kind of know a little bit about the world, but don't know everything, and so act really quickly and seemingly unrational to certain portions of our communities because we don't know. Like, we're not getting to act from a place of wisdom because there's so little we still know about the biological world around us. And I think that's one of the take homes for me, right? If we had, like, you know, that if we had many more people with that type of curiosity that have been figuring this stuff out, we may have already had some of those little informational pieces that would have allowed us to make more informed decisions faster. But I'm sure we will learn from this, right? That is the beauty about being humans. We usually don't let too many tragedies go to complete waste. And so I'm hoping that we learn from this on many different levels.
That's great. No, we're underlining that. We're putting the sayings of Damon on our work table. Wonder, curiosity, and humans always learn from this. That's it. And if it's not true, let's make it true. That's really a crucial dynamic. So, you know, and then last week, you know, I guess, is the oxygen level of the lake improving, as some people were saying on Mitch's, you know, Facebook thing, you know, so we don't need the aerators, or we do, or we will for next time, or where's that?
Yeah, let's dig into that. So all the oxygen was poor for many days at Lake Merritt. So when I say poor, like, usually if you're below what we call like 5 parts per million. Oxygen, you're kind of like bordering where things are dying. And Lake Merritt basically maintained that for at least 6 days from what I can tell. And I was out there with a wonderful kind of community scientist a couple of days ago who had been able to get a hold of a dissolved oxygen probe that was being loaned to her. We went around and did readings and we could see that, you know, it was picking back up. Like, we were headed back towards kind of not being in the dead zone. And I think the report I got yesterday is that in a couple places in the lake, like, it was looking good again, like kind of closer to normal values, which means, you know, we're resolving our way out of this anoxic event. And so now when it comes to aeration of the lake, one of the sticky points there is any aeration I think would have helped during the crisis, because what happened was we ended up with levels all across the lake where nothing could live. And if we at least had just a few places where some of the swimming organisms could have gone, they could have weathered a bit of the storm. Because the sad thing was going back to Lake Merritt every day and just seeing successive die-offs until I stopped seeing die-offs and I just stopped seeing live organisms, period.
Right.
And so I think having a degree of aeration could have at least saved some of those organisms. And
right.
I know the fountains aren't ideal.
Because
they don't aerate a large body. We have one of them on, and technically there are four that have the potential at Lake Merritt. When they were first designed, I think in the 90s, there were four lines built, but really only one of them is running right now, and that's because the fountains go through a lot of damage just from being in the Lake Merritt environment. The organisms attach to them very quickly and damage them. So they're constantly having to pull them off and clean them. And even within that, the rotors and things like that get beat up over time. And so it's this high turnover, high maintenance event to keep those fountains going. Two of the fountains, we can't even run because Lake Merritt has silted up so much. I think the last time the city did dredging was the 1990s. And so that's so badly silted now around those two fountains that they can't even put a fountainhead there for it to run. And then the big asterisk on all of this, because I think it's always important, right, just to be completely honest with the full picture of these things, is those fountains can only aerate about 1 acre of water, and Lake Merritt is 43 acres. And so although they are helpful, right, they're a very small percentage of the oxygenization of Lake Merritt. You know, a lot of the oxygenation comes with the water that's coming through the bay. How is that looking? You know, and in this event, you know, the death came in from the bay. It did not come in from Lake Merritt itself. As the algae kind of came in and the event unfolded in Lake Merritt. So oxygenization is something that needs to be, I think, better studied at Lake Merritt. There have been studies done previously, but those had kind of fallen off over years past, I think, due to funding and then agencies navigating each other. And so I think for a well-being sort of view, that's where a big emphasis needs to be going forward for Lake Merritt in particular, is getting good scientific studies so that we know what should we be doing in order to make this a better environment. Do we want to continue investing in making this place, you know, the gem, the jewel of Oakland, which it is?
Right. And I loved what you said last time, because you said it, you know, it was abundant diversity like Oakland itself, that, you know, all these beings that had come into the bay in bilge water from all over the world, but they'd worked it out into a kind of like, hello, you know, a neighborhood of equilibrium, that wonderful thing that, right? And then we put on our work table, planning, right? And it's like when I did this still sort of haunts me, or I ruminate on it, when I hosted, you know, a very wonderful kind of holistic veterinarian, and I said, well, what does distinguish our species from other species, you know, because I live a lot with animals, you know, and longer than with humans, really. But and he said, planning. I've been thinking about that ever since, going, I don't think our species is really good at planning. I know a lot of coyotes that, I mean, I think everything else is better at planning than humans. It's an option, it's a capacity, but not implemented. Like, you know, and like the oxygenation, it's like, you know, where do we encourage, you know, planning for this ongoing developing, mutating, well, you know, crisis everywhere, right?
And I think it speaks to, like, the oxygenation at Lake Merritt, especially with the fountains, I think speaks to the strength and the weakness of their planning, because it tends to be generational, right? Obviously, there was a lot of work being done sometime before they put in the fountains, of people thinking about this problem and then raising awareness, raising funds, implementing, you know, a solution. But then once the solution was implemented, you know, it feels like that momentum has waned, that momentum of wanting to continually plan for the future for this place. And that comes through various routes, right? But I think it's hard for me to imagine that part of it isn't just because people leave a situation or a generation changes, and all of a sudden that planning that was being carried by one or two torch carriers, bearers, you know, isn't there anymore. And I think that's one of the difficulties that humans have had looking just through history, is that we have these major generational changes or torchbearer changes for planning that, you know, leads to technologies, changes the way we think about the world, all kinds of things. But then getting the next person to pick up the torch and carry it is always a stumbling block.
Yes. And you know, and we did put out sort of a call last week, you know, going, aerators, and a number of people reported in going, well, I know this great guy in Southern California, but he's in Southern California, but he knows a great company that has, you know, gigantic aerators, but they not doing it for free, you know. And then somebody said, what about a GoFundMe, for a citizen's GoFundMe to purchase aerators to step in where the government's just not yet gifted at rapid, ingenious response, right? And so what about the idea of a citizen's GoFundMe for aerators to be brought in now or later?
I think what would be even more beneficial is for that money to come in to do the scientific and long-term planning and kind of solidify that, because that's what we'll continually to bring in things that keep us from going to crisis mode. And to be honest, I have a bit of beautiful news that I don't think I got to share last time, which is that somebody did step up already. It's not going to cover everything, but it's a very decent chunk of money that's coming in to specifically help with the fountains. And so those things are trickling in because people are hearing, they're listening and saying, hey, this is important to me, my community, and we want to put funds, towards this and change this. And I think that's great. It's helping with the band-aid of the event. But I think the GoFundMe or any sort of like group effort right now really needs to go into that long-term planning with building scientific data that then helps us map things out for not my generation, but five generations or more.
Right.
Because working in corporate America, at most we do 5 years at most places I've ever worked. And what we could be doing is thinking about not just us, but everybody after us and making sure that we're giving them space to have decisions on how to continue.
Right. Are you still there? Did you drop away? No, you're there. Oh, did we lose Damon? Maybe, but we'll get him right back. Yeah, long term. Oh, we're checking on Damon. We're in our last minutes here, but this is really, really crucial. And it's when we address the waxing full moon at 17 plus Virgo, 17 plus Pisces. 17 plus Pisces is the Eleusinian Mysteries degree. And what I want to bring up for all of us anyway, while we see if we can get Damon back for the last minutes, is, everything's trying to help the humans out. And the Eleusinian Mysteries, we know a fair amount that people gathered in Eleusis, drank psilocybe mushroom, danced all night, had a personal life-changing vision that they weren't supposed to say. But then everybody saw, Persephone descending into the underworld, an uninitiated Puella maiden, returning initiated queen. And that's just part of the kind of Eleusinian Mysteries full moon, also around now. What can help? Humans need help in perceiving patterns and how to cooperate with them. And there we have that. I can keep going. is Damon there? No. Aha. Okay, keep going. Thank you. Thank you. Let's rummage around again. Who brought what? And what qualities of intelligence do we want to invite in? As Mercury is stationing to retrograde, and people blame it for all kinds of things. All that it is from the Earth's perspective, several times a year, a planet will appear to be moving backwards to us on Earth. And it just invites us to participate by reconnecting, remembering, going backwards and inwards. What have we forgotten that we must remember? And that's where I turn to the many, many shows and life experiences that many of us have of the psilocybe mushrooms, and Paul Stamets, buddy, friend of show, saying that, we're in this riptide of science proving folklore. And that seems also in the crisis that we're all, addressing who brought what and where is indigenous leadership and people who've lived with the cycles and to be brought in, many, many diverse contributors. But as Stamets says, Johns Hopkins is pretty much proving that psilocybe mushrooms increase curiosity, confidence, and kindness. And he says those are leadership qualities. As we're approaching election and all those things, it's like we've outsourced leadership to incompetent sociopaths, right? We want to insource that back in, and the cascade of all interrelated crisis, no isolated crises, just a crisis of, isolation. They're all connected and all speaking to each other, and this kind of rousing renaissance of biomimicry. It's why I like putting, you know, ideal panels in my mind together, and let's see, you know, if we imagine it, and then it incarnates into actuality of, you know, having a panel at Bioneers in April with it's my image, you know, of Damon and Janine Benyus and Michael Stalker and Dave Gallo, and, you know, just again, who brought what, and this cross pollination of knowledge and ingenuity and implementation that we so want. And then I just add in the psilocybe mushrooms. Damon may have disappeared for the moment, but we will have him back someday. But it was...
I made it back through.
Are you there? You made it back through in time to answer the question about mushrooms, because it was an image of a mushroom that first drew you to Lake Merritt on the day of the crisis. Is that right?
Yeah, there's a species there that somebody had seen that we don't usually see in the Bay Area very frequently, so I wanted to go investigate where it was and take a small sample so I could study it further.
And what is it?
It is, the common name is the giant sawtooth, ponderosa.
Oh.
Large, white, gilled mushroom that grows predominantly on dead or dying pine trees. And so there's been a pine tree that the city has been lovely enough to not remove since it's been dead. I think the entire time I've lived in Oakland, they left, you know, about an 8-foot stump. And I have seen, maybe others have noticed, there's been this wonderful unfolding succession of different organisms using this tree's resources. And this is just the most recent notable player to show up.
That's so great. You know, and it's like in nature, the antidote is always next to the poison. And Paul Stamets for a long, long time has been doing bioremediation of water systems with kind of like a John Todd living system with mushrooms to filter out, you know, toxic things. And so it's again this confluence of, you know, dedicated beings like yourself, and then who brought this in from over here, and then, you know, for those of us who are entheo enthusiasts, we go and walk around Lake Merritt while eating microdoses of psilocybe mushrooms that may reveal the pattern, or with a question. So there we are. But thank you so much, Damon Tide, and we're on our way out now. But if you have one last exhortation, curiosity, and wonder, you know, may humans be polite again, what would you want to just leave us with?
I mean, especially for the folks that live around the San Francisco Bay, this is probably one of the most important times that you can just go out to a place you know in the Bay, sit still, and find the questions that the Bay asks you.
That's great.
And you'll find lots of
that. Well, thank you. Thank you always for your work and your generosity and your indefatigable contribution, Damon Tai. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, everybody. Whew. Bye.